If you were in Damayanti's face, any Nala would have done this to you, how would you have reacted? It's a very difficult question. You can never be in somebody's place, first of all. But I think the question is a deeper question. There is a feeling, a complaint against Nala in this question. It seems as if Nala had done something very wrong in regard to Damayanti. So let me first of all ask somebody here, if anybody feels that Nala did something wrong to Damayanti, anybody here who feels it the same way? You all have read the story, no? All of you.
Yes, sir.
Is it true that Nala did something wrong to Damayanti? Let us analyze the situation in which Nala found himself with Damayanti in the forest. The complaint seems to be against Nala's leaving Damayanti in wilderness all alone. It is almost like Sita being exiled by Rama. It's a similar question. In the case of Rama, there was some late justification during the morning. Is there a justification for Nala having done what he did? The author himself gives two reasons, and you have to judge the story in the light of those two reasons. Told Damayanti repeatedly, please go back to your father's house. The future, as he saw, foresaw, was full of danger and difficulty. And he told her to go to her father's house where she could live in peace, relatively speaking, and in safety. But Damayanti was not accepting this request of Nala, saying, I shall be with you and I will share with you all the difficulties of life. Was Damayanti right in insisting on this? Was she not increasing the troubles for her husband by being with him? He had to look after himself in danger. He had also to look after his wife, who was often in a great danger. Was she not increasing the burden on Nala? And even if it was so, the question is, why should he not bear that redoubled burden? It was the duty of the husband to protect the wife, and the wife had the right to be with the husband and to share her his difficulties. And it seems that Damayanti was quite right in insisting that she should join and keep company with her husband. She should not be sitting in the palace, enjoying the comforts of a palace and allowing her husband to go on as he was doing. There's the first issue. The second point is that Nala was already subject to Kali. Now, this is an invisible force. And this aspect of the story may seem to be purely my. And therefore, it may not be appreciated by many people. But we have to give value to the author and his imagination, his story, his setting of the story. He explains that there was an evil force which was at work. Damayanti knew it, Nara knew it. And both were aware of the evil designs or evil fortune that had befallen them on account of the action of the Kali. Now, when Kali is at work, there are situations which are created which are extremely trying. In the morning we had a question whether one is tested by God or not. And I said, God does not test you. But there are many others who test. And one of them is evil force. The evil force certainly aims at torturing you through a process of testing. This is one of the marks of a tyrant. So he was put into a very, very difficult situation because the wrong suggestions would come, wrong ideas would come, and one becomes subject to these wrong ideas. On account of these two reasons, I think Nala left his life in the wilderness. He thought that if he were left alone, then indeed she will go back to her father's house, as it really happened ultimately. And there was no other way on his part by which he could have sent her to a place of safety. But surely it was not an ideal solution. And to that extent, certainly we can blame Nala. The only mitigating factor is that he made mistakes because there was a force of Kali working in him. Now, Damayanti understood the condition of her husband quite well. And that is why she reacted to Nala in the way in which she did. She did not despise Nala. She did not criticize Nala. She understood the real message of Nala. She went back to her father's house. And in her agony of the heart, she shared the difficulties of Nala. This is what I think would explain the plot of Nala and Damayanti's story at this stage. I cannot say that this was an ideal condition, an ideal answer to this situation. But I would put a counter question. How would you react and how would you do the right action in that situation? If the questioner were present, I would have pressed this question. But since the questioner is not present, I will not press this question further. We go to the next one. He was under the influence of Kali. So that is also an aspect. Very true. There is a question. The story of Shakuntala is a love story. And it is considered to be a very inspiring story. It is taught to students at a young age. But then why are love marriages not willingly accepted by the society till date? Would you like to answer this question?
No doubt that the story of Shakuntala is a love story. An emotion, love is a place, very modern place in one's life. Now the question is related with the love marriage. And before this, a pre-question is there in my mind. To what extent love marriage is love marriage? Unless you understand what is the meaning of that, it is bound to fail. It is bound to go to unsuccess. So, the question which we are putting here, that why love marries is denied or neglected or not accepted by the society at large. The question is not that love marriage is not accepted. The question is, with reference to a particular couple and their own willingness, their own say, relationship, at what level of relationship they stand. You might have noticed so many cases. And it is society's privilege to test the relationship, because ultimately they are going to be the member of the society. By violating certain rules, certain practices let down by society itself, they are doing. But they have to prove that in spite of violation of the practices and norms of society, the relationship will stay. And in many cases, to the satisfaction of society, the couple is not unstable. Then they say that on the basis of emotion, on the basis of superficial attraction, on the basis of, say, give and take relationship, they have come under that relationship. Now it is because of society that relationship is tested. And if they stand true to that relationship, society accepts them. So in either case, if it is an arranged marriage or it is love marriage, you have to prove your the worthwhileness, truthfulness, faithfulness of that relationship. If you yourself prove, then no one can come in the way of that. So, in case, for instance, even in case of arranged marriage, there are tests, society, family, and friends at large, they also test that relationship. Because on that relationship, the structure of the society, the preservation of society, the moral system of the society is, say, kept life intact. So unless higher is the relationship, higher is the test. So in that case, once you are taking the responsibility on your own, then you have to prove longer. To a great extent, you have to prove that the truth of that relationship. The question now in ethics, there are so many details and technical things which I do not want to discuss here. But one thing is very important. Because I have been in the university and many cases I have dealt with this question with my students. Why do you want to marry? This is the very, very, very first question. First query which one wants to know. Because one is forwarding his personal choice. Now this personal choice should have a solid ground. For parents, for friends, for relatives and all that. And marriage is a joint responsibility put in for the whole society. Nation, humanity, and even if we philosophically speak, then to, for the whole cosmos. So it is not an event taking place between the two individuals. Families, parents, and relatives, and society at large play a very closely connected with these results or consequences. And that's why thinkers have laid down certain norms for that thing. But if you are violating, so on the other hand, the couple should assure the persons, the individuals, that yes, it is going to be a stronger cemented relationship. So that was consideration there. Failure of marriage is not related with the form of marriage. If you remember, the actress Rekha, who has played a very, impressive roles of wives in so many films. And in her own life, her husband has to suicide. You remember all the marriages performed so spiritual. milliners on the various performance, but then it again fails. So the question is not the form, the question is of the content. The content is powerful or not. That is the basis of the success of marriage. It may be love, it may be arranged, it may be not. And to be on the lighter side, I remember here one episode when it was an interview with Mohammad Rafi, and the interviewer asked him, "Sir," the question was asked to Mohammad Rafi, "Sir, you hate love marriage or arranged marriage?" So he did not say, "I didn't go for love marriage, and neither it was arranged marriage." Then the questioner was very much worried. Then what type of marriage was that? And the answer given by Mohammad Rafi in the interview, which I viewed on TV itself, the answer given by Rafi was that my wife selected me. That's all. So the thing is that in love, whether it is love or simply the emotional or carnal desire, that is to be decided. For that reason, society puts a question mark on that relationship, and that's why it easily doesn't accept. But once you prove your worthwhileness, once you prove the validity and strong bondedness of that relationship, society accepts. Thank you.
It is always a difficult problem, and each individual case is to be considered before you say yes or no. I will not spend time on that question, because if this question is to be answered, I must have a concrete case X, Y, Z, and then you have to answer properly in regard to this question. I come back later on. Why did Dushyanta not legally marry Shakuntala and take her with him to his kingdom? This is asked by Shivali Krishna. Is she here? Good. Very good question. His marriage with Shakuntala was a legal marriage. You cannot say that he did not legally marry her. Gandharva marriage was regarded as one of the acceptable marriages in India. The exchange of garments was enough to perform marriage. Even today in India, exchange of rings or decoration in the civil marriage act is considered to be enough. But there are many deeper questions which will come up now. Why did not Shakuntala fight back? And why did she accept Dushyanta's decision without protests? This is a question put by Harihita Kumar. See here. Why did not Shakuntala fight back? Actually, the greatest merit of the story of Shakuntala is that she did fight back. In fact, there is a film produced by Vishantaram. He produced two films on Shakuntala. One was called Shakuntala and another was called Stri, the woman. In both the films, as he depicted the story of Shakuntala, Shakuntala is shown as a very brave woman. Perhaps some of the authors who have written stories on Shakuntala have not brought out a powerful dialogue between Shakuntala and Dushyant at the time when Dushyant rejects. She indicts all men, in fact. She protests vehemently against the treatment given to her by Dushyant.
Also, she could have gone home back. That would have been a weakness on her part. She refuses to go back to her mother's house. She regards herself to be a married woman. A married woman rejected by her husband, and she accepts all the consequences of that status. And thirdly, it is only when Dushyanta, when he recognizes his fault, repents for it, and asks for pardon from Shakuntala, that she reconciles herself with him. We shall again, some other question comes up, I will make further comments on it. Why didn't King Dushyanta legally announce Shakuntala to be his wife? And why instead involved her with him in a type of secret marriage? Such a type of celebration was easily accepted by Maharshi, the father. Then why such relations are considered illegitimate in the present time? It's a question similar to this question which was answered by Dr. Vyas. But there is one important point here which I wanted to emphasize. The fact was, it was a secret marriage in a certain sense, but it was a legal marriage. She could have waited for the father's return to get the permission from the father, and there could have been an immediate marriage. There was an emotional outburst at that time, which could not wait. And they wanted to be united legally. So on the one hand, when you cannot wait, and yet you want to be legal, this kind of marriage was accepted. And there was no question of betrayal on either side. The difficulty arose only because of a very important event which occurred. And that is Dushyanta's forgetfulness. He forgot. Now this is the central question of the whole drama of Shakuntala. How can one forget such an important event in life? This is the central question. We must remember that this story of Shakuntala is to be read at a very deep level of human existence. Most of the tragedies of life arise out of forgetfulness. The greatest forgetfulness is man's own forgetfulness about himself. We all have forgotten ourselves. This is the basic fact on which Shakuntala's story has been. Self-forgetfulness. Yesterday I was talking to you about the soul and soul's forgetfulness about itself when it comes into the body, and the whole life is nothing but a recovery of one's own memory about oneself. The story of the Mahabharata, in which the story is narrated, is a story of the soul and its forgetfulness, but told in a very dramatic manner, to such an extent that you may ask the question, is it ever possible to forget such an intimate event which had occurred as between Shakuntala and Dushyanta? The answer is yes. The whole drama is entitled Abhijnana. Avijnana is recognition. It is recognition of Shakuntala. The story is of a soul which is born on the earth, which forgets itself. In this particular drama, the forgetfulness comes because of the curse of Arise. But in every case, in our own self-forgetfulness, there is a long explanation as to how we forget ourselves and how we live life as if in a condition of forgetfulness. As a result, the message of the story is that we all live tragically. Our life is a continuous tragedy, which can be remedied only when you attain self-recognition. It's an allegory of the soul, the soul's journey on the earth. There are two questions from Bulbul Roy. Is she here? Bulbul Roy? What is tapasya and what is its significance in our lives? What qualities have the power to lift us above the vulgarities of life? What is tapasya? Tapas is a word which comes from the process of incubation. Is a process of giving warmth, heat. Every process which lifts you up is a process of heating up. Going to the Vedic knowledge, the most important element in the human history is Agni. Every important event in human life is attended by manifestation of Agni. It is when we become cold in life, inert, negligent, that things go wrong in our lives. To be heated all the time and to feel the heat of consciousness, application of heat, that is tapasya. In ancient times, the aspect of tapasya was easily accepted. And in Indian life, Indian culture, tapasya is even artificially generated. People undertake fasting, they take some kind of vows. It is called some kind of infliction upon oneself of something that is uncomfortable, so that due to the discomfort, one is reminded of what one has to do. This is an artificial method. But when one concentrates deliberately on the object, then the true real tapasya begins. The real meaning of tapasya is that of concentration. To apply the force with a concentration upon the object and to continuously radiate your concentration upon the object, when you do that, the object is fulfilled. Even when you want to study a subject and you don't understand a subject, it is said, you just take the name of the subject and go on concentrating only on the word. I don't know what is algebra, for example. You don't understand it at all. You just think about algebra. Do nothing. Just concentrate. One day, 2 days, 3 days. You make an experiment in your life. The meaning of the word algebra will begin to unfold itself, either from within, or somebody will come and speak to you about it. Or you will come across a book in which the word algebra is explained. The circumstances will begin to vibrate around you. And the meaning of the word will be revealed to you. This may look like a magic, but basically all life is magic. Everything in the world is denied because we are not concentrating. The secret of all achievement is concentration. And tapasya is nothing but concentration of energy, steady concentration, continuous concentration, even to the extent that you feel great discomfort, continue on and on and on. One of the greatest examples is that of Parvati, that is also written by Shakuntala, by Kalidasa, the author of Shakuntala, Kumara Sambhava. That is another big epic written by Kalidasa, which shows the tapasya of Parvati, the attainment of Shiva. Mere concentration upon Shiva ultimately melts Shiva, and she gains Shiva. He wants to say that tapasya is connected with temple. All life is basically Agni, and Agni is temperature, but also light. Agni has two aspects. It is not merely temperature. It is fire as heat, but also light. Mere temperature is not enough. For every tapasya, there should be a continuous flow in which knowledge also is added to your movement. You concentrate and more knowledge comes. More temperature you apply, the greater knowledge begins to unfold. And vice versa. Physics and metaphysics both together. In the Veda, we have got a very good word for kavikratu. Kavikratu. Kratu means movement of action. It is from where the word karma comes. Intention to act, motive to act, that is kratu. Kavi is a state of wisdom. When the motive of action is motivated by wisdom, when there is a unity of wisdom and action, when the two are combined together, then there is perfection. Very often we act without knowledge, or we have knowledge but we don't know how to act. That is how many philosophers, they may know a lot of things, but in practical life they are very often zero. And vice versa. Many people who are very dynamic, they may be leaders. At the time of action, a real decision, they find themselves in a great quandary. This is what happened to Arjuna. A man of great action, dynamism. But when he was confronted with a very important issue in his life, he was bewildered. There was Vishada Yoga of Arjuna. He is bewildered. He does not know how to decide what is right and what is wrong. So he turned to Sri Krishna to get kavihood. And when the two combine together, when knowledge and action are combined together, that is why Bhagavad Gita is called the science of union of knowledge and action. Synthesis of yoga. You synthesize knowledge with action. Action with knowledge, knowledge with action. The two, when united together, gives you perfection. And that is the real message of the Bhagavad Gita. And this also answers the question, by what can we be lifted upwards from the vulgarities of life? It is by combining knowledge and action that you can lift yourself from vulgarities of life.